From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Rubin, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, the Trump administration has gone to war with the mainstream media and the First Amendment. Trump thinks letting the press write whatever it wants is a terrible idea. Meanwhile, a right-wing mouthpiece for Trump may be taking over your local TV news. How much of a threat to a free press is Donald Trump? Can the mainstream media cover him objectively, or does objectivity mean complicity? That's coming up on 1 year later after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post. President Trump ran against the press in 2016 and hasn't stopped demonizing it yet. He's even said that he thinks it's a terrible idea that the mainstream media gets to write whatever it wants. But meanwhile, Sinclair Broadcasting, a fixture of right-wing media, is taking over a slew of outlets and may soon determine what you see on local TV news. Here to discuss the Sinclair deal and its impact on news coverage is Stuart Brotman, who teaches political communication at the University of Tennessee, where he is professor of media management and law at UT's College of Journalism and Electronic Media. Welcome, Professor Brotman.
How are you, Jennifer?
I am doing just fine. Tell our listeners, what is Sinclair Broadcasting?
Sinclair Broadcasting is a multiple station owner, so it operates stations throughout the United States. It's primarily in the television broadcast business. And it's in the process of acquiring stations that are owned by another large broadcast entity called Tribune Broadcasting.
And what will that do to local news if those two entities are merged?
Well, I think it remains to be seen. Let me step back and talk a little bit about the process. So the FCC essentially controls approvals of these mergers and acquisitions of broadcast properties. And in this case, Sinclair is asking that acquisition be approved by the FCC. The FCC looks at that through the lens of the Communications Act, and there's a standard there called public interest, convenience, and necessity. That's a very foggy lens in terms of what the standard is. So the FCC at any particular point in time can determine what the public interest, convenience, and necessity is in approving such a transaction. In this situation, Sinclair is proposing that it acquire the Tribune broadcast television stations, and at the end of that transaction, it will essentially be able to reach 72% of the American broadcast television audience. This is over the air.
This seems
right now. I'm sorry, Jennifer.
This seems extraordinary, frankly, that you would have one entity controlling that much of the local news. Has the FCC been paving the way for this kind of merger, this substantial domination of the local TV news industry?
Well, in 2008, there was a major radio acquisition. Clear Channel Broadcasting, which owned a number of radio stations, decided it was going to make a major acquisition, and it wound up acquiring up to 858 radio stations. So today, Clear Channel is called iHeartRadio, and it's in 150 markets. So to some extent, that pales in respect to the Sinclair transaction. Sinclair is much smaller in terms of the overall reach of it. So we've seen really for the past decade an increase in these media consolidation deals, but clearly the iHeartRadio deal of 2008 was the largest of its kind.
Well, I think once it hits the news industry as opposed to music and entertainment, it becomes quite a public controversy. Let's hear now from Jessica Rosenworcel. She's one of the FCC commissioners, and she gave an interview last month to CNN's Brian Stelter. after President Trump made a threat to revoke the license of NBC News, which he called a fake news network.
I think it's important to realize that the Supreme Court characterizes our First Amendment as a profound national commitment to having robust, uninhibited, and wide open debate. And, you know, that debate can sometimes be hard-hitting for public officials, but it is absolutely essential that we support the First Amendment and everything that the FCC does.
If that's the case, where are your other commissioners? Why hasn't your chairman, Ajit Pai, spoken out about this?
Well, I can't really speak to what he's thinking, but I do think that history won't be kind to silence. And I think it's important for all the commissioners to make clear that they support the First Amendment and that the agency will not revoke a broadcast license simply because the president is dissatisfied with the licensee's coverage.
She seems to be arguing that the FCC needs some kind of help or protection to maintain its professional status. Is it in danger of becoming politicized?
I don't think so. I think we've had a history because the FCC, by law, essentially is controlled by whatever party controls the White House. And so you have three commissioners of that party. Currently, with President Trump, we have three Republican commissioners. With President Obama, we had three Democratic commissioners, and the chairman typically is of the same party as the president.
We also have another media merger, AT&T and Time Warner. Suddenly, CNN is in the news and seems to be on the chopping block and on the hot seat for the Justice Department. What's going on there?
Well, this really is not an FCC issue because there is no broadcast transaction that's taking place there. In fact, as part of that, Time Warner indicated that it would sell the only broadcast station it owns, and so therefore the FCC has no authority to look at the deal. All of the action is at the Department of Justice, and all of the action relates to our federal antitrust laws. And as of today, it looks likely that the Department of Justice will essentially file suit in federal court to prevent that transaction from going through.
And will CNN then use the president's tweets and other public statements as evidence that this is not based upon antitrust law, but about personal vendettas or vindictiveness directed at CNN?
Well, it may. Once it's in the court, essentially, it becomes an evidentiary proceeding, and so any evidence can be introduced. As we saw in the arguments for the travel ban, President Trump's tweets were introduced as essentially evidence of bias. And so in this particular case, you could suspect that if that case goes to court, that Time Warner and AT&T may want to introduce evidence of President Trump's tweets about CNN indicating some bias in that transaction.
If you're a viewer or a listener at home, why do you really care whether one company or multiple companies own these entertainment and news outlets?
Well, I think it goes back into our fundamental First Amendment principle, which is a multiplicity of voices. And I think there's the expression of a thousand flowers blooming. And so to the extent that we can get those thousand flowers, that's probably better than having a few hundred flowers or just having a dozen roses.
Lovely metaphor there. Thank you very much, Stuart Brotman from the University of Tennessee. Let me bring in McKay Coppins of The Atlantic magazine and Kirk Bardella, a political commentator and a former spokesman for Breitbart Media. Welcome, McKay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And welcome, Kurt.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jennifer.
My pleasure. McKay, how did we get to the point when conservatives don't believe anything but what Donald Trump tells them?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's something that I've been writing a lot about. You know, there's deep roots in the Republican Party and conservative politics when it comes to kind of attacking the mainstream media and journalism. It goes, you know, you can trace it all the way back to at least Barry Goldwater, who during his 1964 presidential campaign, his press secretary would hand out gold pins to reporters that read Eastern Liberal Press. And, you know, Richard Nixon's vice president, Spiro Agnew, talked about the closed fraternity of privileged men who ran national news outlets. And it kind of has continued from there. There's been a crucial difference, though, I think a shift in the last few years, especially during the Trump era, something that Trump has kind of taken advantage of, which is there's been this kind of proliferation of conservative partisan media outlets that have been able to largely replace mainstream news outlets in the kind of media diets of a lot of Republicans and conservatives in this country. And a lot of those outlets, not all of them, but some of them have rallied around the president and have kind of created this pro-Trump media industrial complex that where information is very tightly controlled, and it's as a matter of just business strategy, they are constantly attacking the rest of the news outlets, saying that you can't get the real truth from them, you have to turn to us, and that's created an environment where it's very hard for information reported by places like the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Atlantic, CNN, to kind of reach those people.
And if you're a listener or viewer to those outlets, you can probably go through life never really seeing something that the White House doesn't approve of. Kurt, you worked for Breitbart, which was founded by Andrew Breitbart as an alternative to liberal media, which he thought was biased, was slanted against conservatives. What was Breitbart supposed to be, and how did it change?
Well, I think in Andrew's iteration of it, it was to tell the stories that he certainly perceived that the mainstream media wasn't telling about what was going on in the conservative movement. And I think that there is a case to be made that there were a lot of things that were going either undercovered or uncovered by the mainstream media, and there was oxygen to be filled, and Andrew was looking to do that. Now, when Andrew died unexpectedly and Steve Bannon took over.
Steve Bannon Breitbart, being the president's senior strategist who's been dismissed now from the White House but returned to Breitbart.
Right. And when Bannon took over, he turned it more into really a political action committee that rather than trying to chronicle what was happening within the conservative movement, he was trying to change it and shape it and drive it and become an active participant in it. And it's a very different thing when you go from a spectator to an active participant. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
Do the readers of Breitbart know what it is? Do they think that they're getting objective news, or do they like just receiving reassurance and cheerleading for their side?
I think the initial audience that they had came from a desire to get news on a differing viewpoint from a more conservative ideological perspective. And one thing that the Breitbart team did very well was tap into the online median and recognizing that that's the direction that news was going. It was going viral. It was going quicker. It was going through social media. And they built their platform really around that concept versus traditional medians like television or day-to-day newspapers. And I think that that audience went there initially because it was one of the only places they could go to reliably get information about people like Jeff Sessions in the Senate or conservative heroes that were undercovered or looked at with disdain by the so-called mainstream media. Now that they're there, the interesting real change is there used to be a really big divide in what you would see on Fox News programming, what you would read on the pages of Breitbart. Well, now they're one and the same. And so you're not getting the differences that you used to have, the diversity and coverage across the entire conservative spectrum. Now they're all just talking to one another, regurgitating the same stuff.
McKay, did the mainstream media do this to itself? Did it do something wrong that turned off a lot of viewers? And if so, what does it do to get those people back and wean them back off the Breitbarts of the world?
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question everyone in newsrooms across America is asking. I mean, look, there's no question that a lot of us in the mainstream media, and this goes back decades, whether intentionally or not, alienated parts of this country, alienated conservatives, maybe people away from the kind of coastal enclaves where a lot of us live and work. And we have to kind of deal with that and grapple with that. And I actually know that a lot of journalists are trying to grapple with that. What I don't know is whether it's really possible to, I don't know if as a matter of editorial strategy, we should be out there trying to convert people from Breitbart readership to, the Atlantic readership. I think that what we can do best, our editor-in-chief here always says, Jeff Goldberg, he always says the best thing we can do is what journalists always do, which is report observable truth, observable reality. And we should do it in a non-condescending way. We should, of course, when it comes to commentary and analysis, try to be as inclusive as possible of all political viewpoints and highlight various ideological viewpoints. But at the end of the day, You know, if news outlets make it their mission to steal readers back from the pro-Trump media and from Trump's Twitter feed, we kind of play into the whole culture war that Trump and a lot of his compatriots are trying to start with the press.
Kurt, observable reality. That's something that I think most Americans used to believe in. Is Breitbart ironically benefiting from sort of a moral relativism, a deconstructionist view of the world that there is no objective reality? It's just what each side says it is.
Yeah, I think one of the changes in our society is that the information era has allowed people to seek out whatever information they want to find from wherever that really suits their own worldview. And Breitbart's perfectly situated as this congregating place where these people with these extreme views, I'm not even going to call them conservative, they're just extreme views out of touch with the mainstream America, they can come together every day, congregate, comment to one another, feed one another, and create this online community that can then be mobilized into political action. That didn't exist 10 years ago the way that it does now. And they've really fed into and profited really from the further tribalism that's going on in this country. And again, if you read Breitbart, and McKay is right about this, there's no converting a Breitbart reader to become an NPR listener or New York Times reader. That's not going to happen. They have no desire to step outside of their own comfort zone and their own worldview. They think that they are absolutely right and everybody else is out to get them. There's no changing that mind. So the role that media entities have left to play is exactly what McKay said. Just tell the truth. Report what's going on. And if anything, try to grow the audience from people who are right now sitting on the sidelines who don't read the media, who don't pay attention to what's going on, and invite them into that conversation to be better informed.
McKay, as we head into a break, tell us a little bit about how this affected the Roy Moore situation. Would we have Roy Moore as a candidate if we had something like a mainstream media that was well accepted?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, look, the reality is that Roy Moore and his campaign have exploited this hatred and disdain for the mainstream media by just saying that being able to deny everything that's been reported that's negative for his campaign. And I think that that's a problem.
Thank you, McKay. We'll be back in just a moment. Again, I'm Jennifer Rubin, and this is One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking about the media in the age of Trump. Joining me has been Kurt Bardella of Breitbart fame, Once Upon a Time, and McKay Coppins of Atlantic. Gentlemen, we're about to hear a conversation about Trump and the media from two of our listeners. One is from Los Angeles and voted for Hillary Clinton. The other is from Littleton, Colorado, and supports President Trump.
My name is Melissa Bemmel, and I've had a career in the film industry, in real estate, and most recently in education. I'm also getting a master's degree in urban sustainability right now. And my politics have always been centric and left-leaning. I voted for Hillary Clinton in the last election. I felt she was the best candidate, but I certainly felt that Mr. Trump was the worst candidate that was on the ticket from all the candidates.
My name is Mike Bond. I'm a novelist, a former war human rights and financial and energy journalist. I'm a longtime liberal Democrat, a former Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate in Montana. I've had a number of high positions in Democratic campaigns, including the Al Gore campaign. Worked for both Barack Obama and Hillary in the past. President of several environmental groups in the past, and a strong background in renewable energy. President Trump is the second Republican I ever voted for. I've been voting Democratic since I was 21, and I felt that we would be in a better position worldwide and in the country under him than any of the other alternatives that presented themselves. My training is as a completely objective journalist, and that has led me to a great dissatisfaction with the media today. There's a combination of things, and you can't blame the media in itself. It's overworked, underpaid. There's not the funding to do the kind of in-depth journalism that used to be done. There's the pernicious effect, if you wish, of instantaneous news, all the trash that comes through the computer, you know, that gets dreamed up in the heads of crazy people everywhere and has no relevance to reality. But journalism today seems to me in most cases, and by this I mean the mainline media from the New York Times to CNN to USA Today, MSNBC, complete lack of objective oversight. And it's politically correct news that a number of things which may be true just cannot get reported. So instead of all the news that's fit to print, we've become a situation where we have all the news that fits our viewpoint. And the sad thing is that it's led many Americans to completely, I believe, misunderstand what Donald Trump is trying to do and the successes that he's had today. Again, I must say it's my own experience as a journalist where the truth and reality was absolutely ferociously protected is what has led me to my present dissatisfaction with most media.
I think that you'll find absolutely no argument for me that the truth in media has been eroded. It's, you know, been eroding, I think, since the 70s when we started to see that, you know, news became entertainment as opposed to actual news. And especially TV news became about ratings and became about a 24-hour news cycle. So, right, you get no argument from me about that. And not only is our news, our truthfulness in journalism eroded, but people's ability to both want to know what the truth is and understand what the truth is has also been compromised. And I would also, first of all, I would add, you know, Fox into the mix. I mean, it's definitely right up there with every other news agency in being biased and not telling the truth in the news. But I would also say that you're also correct that because of the news, people don't really understand the truth about Donald Trump. And I think probably, though, in the opposite way. You know, his actions throughout his entire lifetime have showed him to be a very self-centered and self-focused person, which I don't think is what our politicians are supposed to be about. But I really don't think that has bearing on this discussion. I mean, just because there isn't truth in journalism, I don't think that, you know, that really has much to do about Mr. Trump. So,
yeah, well, I agree with a lot of what you said, Melissa, about the problems that journalism has faced really since, this, as you point out, the 24-hour TV news cycle, and also this downhill slide toward what's terrifying and exciting. I mean, we don't get a cross section of reality on the news anymore. We get things that people will jump onto because it's a new bomb or a new explosion or some other tragedy somewhere else. It warps us in many ways and gives us a false sense of the danger and precarity of our existences. And so I think that I certainly would agree with you there. And this, the problem, of course, when we try to analyze Donald Trump is in most cases we're dealing with the same news reporting. And it's interesting that here's a guy who the bookmakers, when he announced for president, didn't give him one chance in a thousand. And he went on spending very little money to vanquish 20 Republican opponents, most of whom were better funded than he, and then the best funded Democratic candidate in history. And all of this with the media ferociously united against him. Anybody who can accomplish that, whether you like him or not, It's a pretty astounding.
I don't think he had a media ferociously against him. In fact, I think he had the most media for him you could possibly have. He was a TV star, and that's what he was, and that's what he is, and that's what people voted for, because more people knew of him than probably any other candidate who's run in recent history, because he was a TV star.
Well, that was an interesting conversation between a Hillary supporter and a Trump supporter. The only thing they seem to agree upon, McKay, is that they hate the mainstream media. What have we done to lose these people, both of them?
Well, look, I mean, this is supported by polls, by the way. You can look at any number of statistics that show that public trust in the mainstream media is at an all-time low. I tend to view those with a bit of skepticism, numbers like that, because mainstream media is not one entity, right? It's made up of hundreds, thousands of different journalists and news outlets. And I bet both of those people that we just heard, who I think both made reasonable points, also would point to journalists, writers, news anchors, TV shows, newspapers, magazines that they do trust and that they do think are doing a good job. I think that what we've lost as a country is this like common denominator. We talk a lot about the marketplace of ideas in this country. That was one of the founding ideas of kind of the free press or one of the defenses of the free press. But the marketplace only of ideas really only works if reality serves as a regulating force. And when there's not a broadly accepted set of common facts that we're all starting from, it's very hard for us to find common ground as a country. And I think that when you hear both of those people talking about how much they hate the mainstream media or you know, whatever outlets that they don't like, the problem that I see is that they're not starting from the same set of facts. They're not starting from the same reality and then making their cases from there. And I don't see how we can come together as a country or reach any kind of consensus on these issues unless we do that.
Kurt, it did strike me as I was listening to the two of them go back and forth that they themselves are part of the problem. Don't we put some sense of responsibility on viewers and listeners? They know what media outlets are simply telling them what they want to know. They never hear a discouraging word about Donald Trump on Fox. What responsibility do we have as citizens?
I think we have a lot more responsibility than we give ourselves, frankly. At the end of the day, you know, we have our own opportunity to be as informed as we want to be. There is no shortage of resources to become equipped with the facts because of the information technology era that we live in right now. And so, you know, if people choose to live in ignorance, that's on them. If people choose not to show up and vote and they don't like the outcome of the election, that's on them. I also think a lot of what we heard in that conversation reflects, I don't even think it's necessarily a distrust of the media. It's that people are so tired of bad news that they oftentimes blame the messenger, which unfortunately is the media. They are the ones reporting what's going on in this country. A lot of the things that we hear day in and day out are terrible things that we don't even want to think about. And I think people are just exhausted from that. And so rather than the question being in polls, do you trust the media or not? I wish the question were, are you tired of bad news? Because I think that's symptomatic of what's really going on right now. People are just exhausted from the tsunami of negativity that we are inundated with every day because we have a commander-in-chief who has no impulse control and tweets his every single thought that goes on. Because we have pervasive cultural, very ugly stuff coming to the forefront right now that we're forced to talk about that most people don't even want to think about. So I think a lot of what we're seeing with the connotations against the mainstream media are simply because they're the vehicles for which they are informing us about all these terrible things going on.
Right. Let's hear the second part of that conversation from Melissa and Mike.
I'll just give you a brief thing from today's New York Times that Trump's position on trade, they say, and this is a leading article, is good for corporate America, but not so for the workers. And this is a really interesting dichotomy which the New York Times raises, and it's really Marxist, i.e. that what's good for a corporation can't possibly be good for the worker.
Look, for every New York Times article you can find that's biased, and yes, they're a left-leaning newspaper, they're biased, you're going to find just as many biased articles in, you know, the Wall Street Journal, which is right-leaning, or the Post, or, I mean, this is the nature of people, and people make up journalism. People are biased. You know, what's good is knowing what the bias is, and then if you have a group of people leading those organizations that say, look, we know what we are, but we have to adhere to some sort of, you know, code of ethics whereby we don't let that bias, you know, run away with us.
I don't think that we should be working toward bias. I don't think that it's the proper task of a news organization to slide their bias into their reporting, which is what the New York Times does, what the Washington Post does. There are so many
conservative-leaning papers as well. This is not a liberal.
Oh, I agree. It's everybody.
This is a problem across the board.
Oh, absolutely.
And I agree. I mean, what I'm saying though is you can't get away from bias because everybody has their opinion, and everything comes from your beliefs and your opinion. So the most important thing is to start from a place where you know what that is. Of course, then, you know, like I said, people who are running our government, our, you know, education, people who are running our important institutions, you know, they're supposed to be able, the whole point is to get past their biases. And, right, harder and harder to do and less and less reward for doing that. People are just rewarded for sticking to their biases and clinging to, you know, their differences as opposed to, you know, coming together and saying, you may have this view, I may have that view, but still we can work together and we can compromise. Look, fake news is pretty much a term that he coined, and he is the biggest perpetrator of, you know, fake news and bias. I mean, this is what he is all about. I think it's actually, you know, a strategy of his to sort of detract from what really needs to be done, and the fact that maybe he's not up to the task of doing what needs to be done.
Well, you know, I think once again that a lot of the information that you're getting, Melissa, is from these same biased news outlets. So, in essence, if that were the case, then
his own Twitter feed.
Then we don't really know what's really going on.
Well, gentlemen, that was a spirited debate between our listeners, Mike and Melissa. McKay, as we end our time together, I have a very basic question, kind of a meta question. Are we ever going to agree on what truth is, what objectivity is?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's the most troubling thing that I heard in that conversation, is this idea that both of them so distrusted the outlets and the news sources that the other was getting their information from, that there was just no way that they believed that they could come to an agreement or consensus on anything. In fact, you even heard the Trump supporter there say, you know, well, who knows if what you're saying is true, because it's all coming from biased press. I am ultimately, you know, an optimist when it comes to, you know, what we like to call at The Atlantic, the Enlightenment values of, you know, there is objective truth, there is observable reality. I think that we're going through a difficult time right now, but we still see every day solid journalism exposing corruption, you know, laying out the objective truth of various situations, and it has an impact. The world still responds to that. So I don't think that we can give up on that quite yet.
Well, I admire McKay's optimism. I have my good days and my bad days on that subject. We'll have to leave it there. McKay Coppins of Atlantic and Kurt Bardella, political commentator, former spokesperson for Breitbart. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with One Year Later from PRI. I'm Jennifer Rubin, back with One Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show when we talk it out, when we talk through a big political story or several political stories of the day with two viewpoints. Since I'm representing the right, we're bringing in Emily Tisch Sussman, campaigns director for the Center for American Progress and CAP Action. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. Let's start with the end-of-year rush. When people are rushing around to do their Christmas shopping, Congress is rushing around on a whole list of things that they have to get done. They're trying to pass a tax bill, a spending bill, maybe fix DACA, finally get with CHIPS, which is the health care program that covers millions of children. Then this morning, congressional Democrats back out of a scheduled meeting with Trump, saying that they'll negotiate with Republicans. That follows Trump's declaration that he's not going to make a deal with Democrats. And then we have Chuck Schumer heading to the floor of the Senate to explain what the problem is.
We don't have any time to waste addressing the issues that confront us. So we're going to negotiate with Republican leaders who may actually be interested in reaching a bipartisan agreement. If the president, who already earlier this year said, quote, our country needs a good shutdown, if the president isn't interested in addressing the difficult year agenda and wants to make the government shut down, will work with those Republicans who are interested in funding the government, as we did in April.
Emily, we now have this standoff over a meeting to discuss whether there's going to be a standoff. The Democrats say they're not coming. The Republicans say you better show up. Are we really heading for a shutdown here?
I hope not. I hope we can find a way to actually keep the government open, keep the government running. Our standard has gotten so unbelievably low, right? Like, we're just trying to keep the government open at the same funding levels. That's a pretty low bar.
Right.
And look, and the reason they said they wouldn't show up is because Trump did what Trump does. He took to Twitter this morning, and he basically indicated that he would not be negotiating in good faith. Well, the Democratic leaders have gone and met with him before, but they felt like if he wasn't going to approach it with good faith, then it would just be a photo op for him. He did get a fair amount of credit from people that want to see him as a good negotiator for making a deal, I'll put it in quotes, deal with Democratic leaders earlier in the year to extend the debt ceiling. And they just didn't want to go for it again. If he's not going to come in with anything real and he's just going to try to, you know, throw around blame from the beginning, then it's not a serious negotiator. And they said very clearly they would rather negotiate with the people that actually want to keep the government open.
When the Republicans shut down the government in 2013, Democrats had a field day. But now that the shoe's on the other foot, do Democrats actually welcome a shutdown if it means that they might get something like DACA or might finally get the continuation of CHIPS, the health care program for children?
Definitely not. We're not looking for political gains here. They want to legislate. Democrats in the Congress want to legislate. And the fact that these have become political footballs, I mean, children's health insurance, you know, DACA recipients who have lived their entire lives in the United States, the fact that these are considered to be like left political footballs, I think is really unfortunate and shows how far we've gone.
Well, it would seem that Democrats do have some leverage. How much leverage do you think they have? Because remember, Republicans don't really want to pass a lot of these spending bills. In order to keep the government open, the Republicans are going to have to turn to Democrats. So can they extract a pound of flesh for this?
Well, the only reason Democrats have leverage in the first place is because the Republicans really can't keep their caucus together, right? So right. Republicans are in charge of the White House, House, and Senate. They could actually pass whatever they wanted. But the fact that now they are actually tasked with legislating as opposed to just running against a president, running from the minority, you can make big promises when you're just running. When you're actually governing, it's much harder. And so now you have to be faced with choices. If you say you want to defund things, if you say you want to cut things, well, that means that programs don't get funded. And are you really willing, or the deficit explodes? And so Republicans are having that conversation internally within the party right now, but they really can't come to a consensus. And it is where Democrats end up having some leverage.
Moving on to another big topic that we've seen over the last few weeks, it seems like it's going to continue on, is the fallout from sexual harassment scandals. Al Franken gave a press conference on Monday. It was very sincere, very poignant, seemed to be apologetic. Can he save his job, or should he save his job?
Look, all that is still very unclear. There's more coming to light every day. It's something that is really heavily felt in Washington right now. And I would imagine in many places around the country that one unintended consequence of the election of Donald Trump is that so many women were so deeply hurt maybe had trigger responses to, you know, the Access Hollywood tape, to the way that he treated women, the way that he spoke about women, that they felt like if the change isn't going to come from the top, if the change isn't going to come from the president, he shows no remorse, he can't even acknowledge that he did these things, well, then the culture has to change. Then women really have to take it into their own hands. And so many women in different positions are feeling more comfortable and empowered and supportive of one another. Look, we hear this across the board, that news organizations weren't interested in reporting, that business reporting structures weren't as interested in hearing complaints from women. But there's so much more of a supportive culture now about people coming forward that it will start to come out. I mean, and we really don't know entirely how to handle all of the allegations. And I think that will have to evolve.
Well, Emily, they say free advice is what you pay for. But listen, why are you Democrats obsessing over Bill Clinton all of a sudden? It seems like you want to go back, apologize for not being tougher on him. What's the philosophy there? Or is this just liberal guilt as opposed to good politics, which would be going after the current president?
I think liberal guilt is probably the best way that you can describe it. I mean, what's tough about you know, the order in which things are coming out, I'd say is that, you know, the president did admit to sexual assault in the Access Hollywood tapes. He's now saying maybe the tapes were fake. At the time, he said they were real. You know, look at that. And then the next order of events is that, you know, a Republican Senate candidate has been accused of not just serial sexual assault, but against children and against teenagers and trolling for them. And so then there becomes this obsession with, like, both sides-ism, that we want to make sure that it's not a partisan thing, so that when allegations are made against Franken, which are serious and should be taken seriously, but we also should acknowledge they're not in the same category as serial pedophilia. That we, you know, we Democrats feel like a very intense guilt around saying we want to make sure this is not partisan. We want to make sure that everyone's held accountable.
Well, my advice would be get over it, guys. We've got bigger fish to fry going forward. Switching to another topic, we had the very bizarre situation this week when Project Veritas and its founder, James O'Keefe, tried to fool my colleagues at The Washington Post with a fake Roy Moore victim story. He was trying to, obviously, to once again undermine the credibility of the mainstream media. Did this actually help in your eyes? I'm not objective, but you perhaps are. Did he actually help the Post and the mainstream media by showing that they have standards, that they're not going to let flim-flam artists take them for a ride?
I actually think it did. I think it really did bolster the credibility. Look, you were having a conversation about the fact that people can't agree on what truth is. Project Veritas itself used the Washington Post article to then fundraise as saying, like, it was such a great success for us. I'm not entirely sure how they could find that to be a success when it was found that, you know, it's very seriously proven that they're trying to plant articles or trying to corner reporters into saying political things they aren't saying. I think probably the strongest perspective to bolster the credibility of the Post and, you know, written papers in general and investigative reporting is the fact that even though the Project Veritas person tried to railroad them into saying, into publishing a story that was would be incredibly salacious. I mean, the things that she was saying were, you know, certainly newsworthy if they were true. That they wouldn't do it. You know, they wouldn't just publish it just based on her allegations, and they actually really did look into it. I think by laying out every piece of the process there, it does give people more more faith in you know, I don't know if it's mainstream media, the Washington Post specifically, but it's very scary to think that this is actively happening.
Right. Well, I must say that Roy Moore's wife paid us, I think, the greatest compliment, which was that she said that the Washington Post had talked to everyone that they know. That does seem to be a bit of a backhanded comment that says that mainstream media is out there actually scouring for facts.
Right. I mean, I think it depends on the perspective that you come into it with to begin with, right? Like, if you're looking to bolster the fact that you believe that the Post and that mainstream media is doing a good job, then you interpret that as saying, oh, they really are checking out all the facts. They really are being thorough. I can imagine she was not attempting to give a compliment, that she was probably trying. I cannot imagine that she viewed it in that way. But I think it just speaks to the fact that people's biases are so strong that they interpret even the same piece of information based on the bias they come into it with.
You know what I worry about, Emily, is there will be someone who comes forward with a fake account and a fake story, and that will give everyone license to say, see, these women are making it up. They're not trustworthy. Do you have that same concern? And if so, does this make you feel a little bit more comfortable that those sorts of people are going to get vetted through the process of good journalism?
You know, it's really interesting. I was talking to a reporter the other day who had covered the Sandusky trial, the Jerry Sandusky trial.
And that was the football coach at Penn State who was convicted of multiple cases of pedophilia.
Yes. And so what he was saying was that to cover that story and to cover Roy Moore are so different as a journalist, because to cover the Sandusky trial was about a court of law. It was about, you know, facts coming forward that had been vetted or that were being vetted, and applying the law, applying facts to the law. And trying to get to the truth in that way. But in any of these, you know, whether it's Roy Moore, you know, these are not going through a court of law. These are essentially going through a court of public opinion. And it's important that we have these conversations because he will potentially be elected. And so it's a question about what we want from our leaders. But there's no way to get to that quote-unquote truth because it's not a court of law.
And so we kind of have to weigh the pieces of information as they come to us. It does make me feel better that places that are, you know, I would consider to be legitimate, like the Washington Post, are very carefully vetting. You know, it's not just people that are trying to do harm, although the Project Veritas situation is really egregious and extreme. But look, there are people that are also, you know, mentally unstable, people that want to feel like they are a part of the story. And so they'll remember things in new ways.
Right. We'll have to leave it there. Thank you, Emily Tisch Sussman of the Center for American Progress. That's it for today on When You're Later. Meet us back here tomorrow. 1 year Later is a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International. We're going to leave you with Hotel California. Politics these days sure does seem like you can check it out anytime you like, but you can never leave.
Public Radio National.